Don't lighten up. This is the world. I'm Marco Werman. Today, how many women around the globe are resisting the pressure to make their skin as light as possible.
A lot of the commentary was to stay out of the sun so that I wouldn't, so to say, lose my color, which is an interesting way to phrase it.
Also, a U.S. official weighs in on the Syrian refugee crisis in Europe.
The answer to that crisis is to create a home for the Syrian people to go back to, away from Bashar al-Assad, so that the Syrian people don't have to worry about getting gassed or barrel bombed every day.
Plus, 2 years later, the mystery of flight MH370 only deepens.
This is like a murder case without a body. You need to get a hold of the wreckage. Otherwise, it can never be explained. You need physical evidence.
That's all today on The World. Glad you could be here with us. Not sure if you've noticed, but today is International Women's Day. And in this half hour, we'll be hearing stories about how women around the globe are fighting for their rights. In a few, one woman's battle in Brazil to save her home from demolition ahead of the Rio Olympics. Let's turn first, though, to an issue that many women around the world are fighting, the obsession with lighter skin. In Nigeria, for example, one of the most popular cosmetic products for women is a skin lightening cream. And in India and cultures across Asia, women grow up believing that fairer skin is better than darker skin. So what is behind this obsession with lighter skin? Naini Tyagaraja, a Sri Lankan-Canadian filmmaker, has made a documentary called Shadism. Naini, what do you think is going on with this obsession with fair skin?
Well, shadism is an issue that's existed globally for centuries. I would connect it directly to histories of colonialism across the world. That's why you see it everywhere. And this idea that power and beauty is associated with whiteness. I can give one personal example. Coming from Sri Lanka, which experienced successive colonization, first by the Dutch, then the Portuguese, and then the British, power and beauty was associated with white people and whiteness.
At a personal level, Naini, do you consider your own skin dark or fair? And when did this whole thing become a thing in your life?
I was considered fair by my family. And a lot of the commentary that I experienced wasn't necessarily for being darker skin, but more so for preserving or maintaining or not losing my lighter skin. And so a lot of the commentary was to stay out of the sun so that I wouldn't, so to say, lose my color, which is an interesting way to phrase it. Mm. I always laugh because we've traveled a lot for the film. And so even my mother has said, you've lost your skin color forever because of all the travel. And it's interesting to hear that commentary even now after working on the film.
Were you put on a pedestal because you had light skin?
Yeah, and I don't think I noticed it as much when I was younger. Looking back, I can see that I grew up with a lot of privilege. For me, weight was always my issue. But now looking back at a lot of my experiences, yes, there was definitely a difference.
So you've made this documentary, Shadism, and I'm just curious to know, what was it like making this and meeting women who have very different values placed on the shade of their skin?
Yeah, I think that's one of the biggest challenges that I faced, and rightfully so. I think it was an important critique from other women of color who questioned, what does it mean for me as a South Asian woman who, for the larger part of my life, has been lighter skinned, to tell these stories ethically and responsibly when that's not my experience. But it was an important critique, because if I didn't receive that earlier on, I don't think I would have been cognizant to tell the stories in an honest way.
So there's the cultural aspect. There's also the health aspect to skin lightening that's really negative. How many women did you meet while you were making this doc who used bad skin lightening products and permanently damaged their skin in the name of beauty?
We traveled to Somalia, and when we spoke to women there, they all talked about how it's normalized to use skin lightening creams, and that if you don't do it, people think that you don't have money or that you can't afford it. And even lighter skin women express the fact that using skin lightening creams is important because you feel like the darker skin women are catching up to your skin tone. And so that was kind of an interesting sentiment I heard there. The only other person in the film who openly admitted to using skin lightening cream was my mother. She'd never gone for bleaching at a beauty salon, but she had used the creams. Maybe I think she stopped using them 2 years ago, but she had been using them.
So what is the argument you would present for why women should not use these skin lightening creams? Is it about self-acceptance, and how well does that work in parts of the world where women are not empowered?
What I've seen in terms of shadism and actual movements, there is a movement in India, the Dark and Lovely campaign, which really pushes for, you know, acceptance and respect and love for women with darker skin. But I think that it really starts with conversations in our communities and with others about how it makes us feel. I think that's where the change really starts to happen, and we don't have to look outside for it.
Filmmaker Naini Tyagaraja will be screening her documentary, Shadism, about the trend of skin lightening products tonight in Halifax, Nova Scotia. Naini, thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
Apparently, the skin lightening trend has even captured the market in Brazil now, a country that seemingly has room for many, many different skin tones. But this next story is about a woman in a Rio slum who's been waging a different fight to keep her home from being demolished ahead of the Olympics. Maria da Penha is her name. She's a resident and activist in the Vila Autodromo favela in Rio de Janeiro. The favela, or what's left of it, sits in the shadows of the new Olympic Park. Over the last few months, the government has been demolishing homes there to make way for new construction, and this morning they tore down Maria da Penha's house, one of the last ones still standing there. Will Carlos with our Global Post team is based in Rio, but is with us in Boston this week. Last week, Will, you interviewed Maria da Penha outside her home. Take us to this favela. Where is it in Rio? And give us the before and after shots. What did it look like before Olympic construction started? And what does it look like now?
So I wasn't there beforehand, but I've seen plenty of photos and talked to plenty of residents. Apparently, it was a very nice, quiet place to live. When people think of favelas, they think of kind of big, rowdy slums. This was a pretty small community, apparently very safe, very low crime rates. Everyone describes it as a really nice place to live. It's in the Barra da Tijuca neighborhood, which is in the south of Rio, where most of the Olympic stuff is going on. Now it looks like a bomb's hit it, basically. It's just sort of fields of rubble with a few structures here and there where people are hanging on and still living there.
So Maria da Penha was one of the last people in this favela. Where did the rest of her neighbors go?
So there have been various different kind of buyout options where people have been given this option of moving to a local public housing just down the street where there's a swimming pool and a kids' playground and stuff. A lot of people took apartments there. Some people have taken buyouts that have allowed them to go and buy properties elsewhere. And then there's about, I think it's about 50 families or so that are still hanging in there and are still in the community.
Was Maria da Penha kind of just hanging on till the very last second, and why was she doing that?
Pretty much. What she's trying to get is she's trying to get the government to promise that some of the people can remain on that land. The government has said that they will build sort of a small housing area for the remaining residents who want to live there. Unfortunately, it's never actually made good on those promises. So when I talked to Maria last week, she said this isn't just about her. This is much more of a symbolic fight, kind of the little man fighting against big government. She says this is a fight about rights. She's not fighting for money, and she thinks all citizens need to be respected, and that sadly, the society in Brazil, the government, a lot of the time just doesn't respect the rights of humble people, of people who live in communities, which is the word for favelas in Brazil.
So, Will, you were saying that the government says they're going to build this kind of small piece of property for the Olympics. Have they gotten any more specific about what's going to go into this favela when all the demolition is done?
They really haven't yet. And this is, in many ways, as a fellow reporter mentioned to me, it's kind of a war of information at this point. The residents have been working with local universities to actually draw up some plans of what they want this land to look like, with suggestions making allowances for all the stuff that the government wants to build there. But the government really hasn't come out and said or offered plans and shown pictures of what's going to happen. A little bit after Maria's house was torn down, the government did announce that it would be coming out with plans. So we're going to see them pretty soon. But as Maria da Penha told me, they kind of say one thing and do another. She says when they do an interview with the media, they say that everything's great, it's all going to be good. But at the end of the day, who's it good for? It's just good for them. And that for humble people like her who live in favelas, it never ends up well.
A woman like Maria da Penha, what does she do for a living, and does she have kind of the resources to create a new life for herself?
I'm not sure exactly what Maria does for a living, but most of these people, I mean, they're really working people, domestic servants. They work in shops and things like that. And the basic answer is no. Rio is a very expensive place to live. These aren't people who've got vast savings that they can go to go and buy a new property. And their main point is that where they were living was very safe. It was a very secure place. And to find somewhere that's safe in Brazil, you've got to go to a nice neighborhood. It's expensive.
So there were evictions happening before the World Cup in 2014 to build the soccer stadiums. Now this is happening again. So it really doesn't sound like Brazil has changed its ways or has really been listening to the people.
They say that they have, that they say that they've made this more open, more transparent. But at the end of the day, the people who are caught up in the middle of this, people like Maria de Peña, say that really what's going on in Vila Autódromo is really indicative of the way the Brazilian government works. She says, and it's not just in my country, but in countries all over the world, where there are mega events like this, the people who end up suffering are the poor.
Will Carlos, a correspondent in Rio with our Global Post team, thanks for telling us about all this and about Maria de Peña's fight.
Always a pleasure. Thank you.
One migrant deported, one refugee admitted. That's essentially the deal that Turkey and Europe are close to making right now. Essentially, under this deal, all migrants crossing by boat from Turkey to Greece would be deported back to Turkey. Then the European Union would agree to admit an equal number of Syrians selected from those staying in refugee camps inside Turkey. My BBC colleague Damian Grammaticus is in Brussels, where officials discuss the plan today.
Essentially, what they're saying is that they would deport everyone who crossed over to Greece and then go into camps in Turkey. And I think it would be the UN that would have to administer this, who would decide, say, Syrians who are eligible for asylum, who could then be moved into the EU.
Yeah, I would expect that to be one of the big problems, though. How do you decide eligibility?
There is a really serious legal issue here, which is that just describing those landing on Greek islands as illegal migrants is problematic under international law, because people have the right, everyone has the right, to cross a border and seek protection internationally. If you say, I'm fleeing a country where there is war, persecution, whatever, the obligation is on the country that you arrive in to hear your case.
Now, in part, I gather the plan is supposed to deal with the volume of new arrivals, but on paper, it's also supposed to deal with the traffickers. Explain how that's going to work.
Yes, well, what European leaders said late at night when they emerged from their meetings is that their aim is to break the business model. And what they mean is that the vast amounts of money that those traffickers in Turkey are making, $1,000 at least is the normal price per person to get in a flimsy rubber dinghy and cross the sea. There's huge amounts of money there. So that's one thing they want to stop, is the incentive for people to cross. Now, so I think what they want is if refugees and migrants would understand that they got on a boat, crossed to Greece, that money was spent for nothing if they were simply returned, then the traffic would dry up. That's the idea that European leaders have. But already many refugees, we know, every time an obstacle or a route is closed, they find another way around, and they may pay even more to do that and take even greater risks.
Just last year, Damien, Angela Merkel, the German chancellor, was welcoming refugees to Europe. So this seems to be a big turnaround for the EU. Why this change now?
Because of internal political pressures inside Europe that have risen in the space of the past year with the million arrivals that we've seen. First of all, in Germany itself, Angela Merkel has come under criticism internally from many different quarters, and she's seen her own popularity slipping. She faces crucial regional elections in the coming week. That's another concern for her. There's the rise of an anti-immigrant party in Germany that is troubling her too. But it's worth saying that, you know, many humanitarian groups, the UN itself has been coming out today saying, really, this is a problem that should be easily manageable for Europe. A million arrivals into one of the richest continents in the world with a population of 500 million should be a manageable thing if they could be distributed evenly around Europe. The problem is European leaders have not been able to agree that politically.
My BBC colleague Damian Grammaticus in Brussels. Appreciate it. Thank you.
Pleasure.
I'm Marco Werman. You're tuned to The World. Social media is huge in Saudi Arabia, kind of intriguing for a nation not exactly known for freedom of expression. My colleagues at the BBC were intrigued as well. So to find out more, they canvassed various active voices on Saudi social media for a series they call Saudis on Social. May Noman is behind the project.
Saudi Arabia is a nation where 75% of the population is under 30. So there's a huge young population there. And they're mostly on social media, spending roughly 8 hours a day on social media. They're on any platform that you can think of. Facebook is the most popular. But when it comes to campaigning, they usually use Twitter. But there's equally fans of Instagram. They spend a lot of hours watching comedy and sport on YouTube and whatever new platform you can think of, whether it's Snapchat, Telegram, Kik, they're just on it.
So campaigning, comedy, and sports, what kind of things are they campaigning for on social media?
Well, it differs really. So, I mean, you've probably heard about the Women Driving campaign, and that was one of the biggest mm-hmm. campaigns on Saudi social media on Twitter. But there's also several campaigns where women also complain about the situation, whether it's harassment on the street or, you know, they recently were allowed to vote and take part in parliamentary elections, but actually they were not given or allowed to sit with their male counterparts. So again, people were campaigning and questioning these decisions. And what actually struck us was the fact that engagement on topics on Twitter in Saudi Arabia far exceeded any engagement in the region. I mean, a country like Egypt is, you know, it's got a massive population of over 80 million people. And again, these are people who are mostly young and engaged on social. But when it comes to a social conversation, Saudi Arabia really has surpassed any other Arab country when it comes to engaging.
That's extraordinary. So it's not just social. That social gets political. And as you found, it also gets religious, which in Saudi Arabia is political. Tell us about one of the people you spoke with, a man named Mazen, this atheist who lost sight in his eye. What did he tell you?
So Mazen's story is one of three anonymous Twitter accounts that we covered under the freedom theme under this series. And his story, he told us that he lost his eyesight when he was seven. And he, you know, he grew up in a country where there are few Braille books in Arabic for the blind. So he wasn't really exposed to reading that much. But then when he grew up a bit, he found online tools for the blind. And that's when he started really exploring the world beyond his own family and community. He talks us through the journey of losing his faith and continuing his journey online, sharing his views with like-minded people, but also with other Muslims in Saudi Arabia.
Do you think there is an indirect correlation between the permissiveness of a government like Saudi Arabia's and the massive use of social media? I mean, how do you explain the supersized use of social media in Saudi Arabia otherwise?
Well, I mean, there have been, we found a few things that might be the reasons why. So one of them is the huge youth population there. But another reason was that, you know, these are young people who don't have space to socialize and do things other than going to the mall, for example. So, you know, these are young people who have a lot of time on their hands and they've got access to internet and they've got also local content. So, you know, the Saudi comedians that we spoke to, these are, you know, the new superstars of Saudi, and they're the celebrities now.
So Saudi comedians, they have a lot of followers. Who else in Saudi Arabia? Who are the celebrities who have a lot of followers and a lot of influence?
So we profiled the most followed people on Facebook and Twitter, and we found that the biggest five accounts on Facebook and Twitter belong to religious preachers, Muslim religious preachers. And that was surprising and not surprising at the same time. It was surprising that they were all, the top five were all religious clerics, because we usually have this image of religious preachers as people who kind of sit in mosques and preach in a very formal language. But actually, they've in Saudi Arabia, they've been amongst the people who really understood this new trend and jumped on it and are now, you know, the top cleric. Muhammad Al-Arefi's got 13 million followers. That is
Whoa.
A huge number that competes with,
yeah,
I don't
Kim
know,
Kardashian,
Leonardo DiCaprio's of the world. So it's huge. And they've got a lot of influence, not just in Saudi Arabia, but this we're talking about the Arab world and the Muslim world in general.
So, May, how do you think the Saudis' access to so many social media platforms and all this engagement with users, how's that going to change Saudi society in the long run, do you think?
Well, we posed that question to many of the people we spoke to in Saudi. And some said, you know, this is just a tool for us like anywhere else in the world where we're now able to communicate with each other because they could be so segregated, especially the sexes. So obviously it's changing the nature or the culture. It's quite interesting to watch that unfold, but how much that would change society, the real society, we'll still see that.
Yeah, well, watch this space. My colleague at the BBC in London, May Noman, telling me about social media's big footprint in Saudi Arabia. May, thank you so much.
Thank you, Marco.
A quick note before the newscast, and this is a story that had some help from social media. It's about Hanako. She's Japan's oldest elephant and the star attraction at Inokashira Park Zoo in Tokyo. In 1949, Thailand gave Hanako to the government of Japan as a post-war goodwill gesture. Since then, Hanako has spent most of her 69 years in captivity, and now she's at the center of a campaign, an online petition, to help her live out the rest of her life in a bit more comfort.
Her treatment is excellent. Her facilities are what have failed.
That's Carol Buckley. She's an American elephant expert hired by the zoo to help design a better living space for Hanako.
She's living on concrete, which is very unhealthy for elephants. The other thing is it's a small area, which is contrary to the natural situation for elephants. They are migratory by nature. In the wild, they'd walk 30 to 50 miles every day, so they are biologically designed to be moving all the time. So as a result, not only did she not get enough exercise throughout her life living at the zoo, the environment was quite boring, sterile, no trees to rub on, no dirt to throw on her back, just nothing to engage her and stimulate her.
The worst part, though, no companionship.
Oh, it's awful that she's alone. The worst thing you can do for a female elephant is to keep her solitary.
Buckley says it's too late to reintroduce Hanako into the wild. She might not be able to form bonds with other elephants. And bringing a new elephant into her enclosure might not work either. Buckley's recommendation, more quality time with those she loves most, her handlers.
Quality time, not sweeping the floor and moving food. Quality time. What she's asking for is to be pet, stand next to them, purr, talk to them. So that is, you know, that's to me the biggest thing that she needs right now.
Of course, a little more space for Hanako wouldn't hurt either, Buckley says, but it is Tokyo, one of the world's most crowded cities, so that could be difficult. What's that riddle again? How do you find an elephant? Yeah, easy if you're in Tokyo. Coming up later on the show, the Latvian scientist behind Meldonium, the substance that has unstrung Sharapova's racket. You're with the world. I'm Marco Werman. Cod stocks are low, but dogfish is plentiful. The rest of the world loves it, but Americans, not so much.
I don't want to mislead anybody. It's not codfish, but it could be a good substitute. It's a nice, flaky white fish and very tasty.
Smoked dogfish beignets with red pepper aioli, anyone? That's coming up right here on The World.
The World is brought to you by Public Radio International with support from TIAA CREF, a global financial company that's created to serve and built to perform. You can learn more at TIAA.org.
I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. The talks aimed at ending the war in Syria are a fragile undertaking. The various sides won't even sit in the same room together, much less around the same table. Indirect discussions were slated to resume tomorrow in Geneva. Now United Nations officials say they may not start in earnest until next week. Meanwhile, a partial ceasefire agreed to in previous talks is barely holding. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry is pushing hard for a negotiated settlement in Syria. Retired Admiral John Kirby is Kerry's spokesman. Kirby says the ceasefire has created some space for the peace process to move forward.
The cessation of hostilities is actually holding, and it's holding quite well. Yes, there are violations, but the truth is that for the first time in 5 years, the Syrian people are living with a level of reduced violence in the country, and that's just indisputable by the math.
So there is this seeming cooperation between the U.S. and Russia, but Arab media are full of speculation about another deal, a more quiet deal brokered by Moscow and Washington about Syria. Is there more agreement between Washington and Moscow than we realize?
I don't know if there's more than you realize. I mean, I think we've been pretty open and honest about the things that we've been working with Russia on with respect to getting to this point in Syria. But look, this is a complicated relationship, and there are plenty of things where we still don't see eye to eye with the Russians. In fact, that we're adamantly opposed, and that's, you know,
like what?
Like Ukraine, for instance. We absolutely don't have the same view of what Russia's done in Ukraine as what Moscow has.
What about disagreements on Syria right now? Are we still divided on Syria?
I think on Syria, we have closed the gaps that we once had with Russia. I wouldn't go so far as to say that the Russians and the Americans have exactly the same view going forward with the political process, but that's why these talks are so important.
After some serious concerns in Washington, though, about Russia not holding up its end of the bargain, like not bombing opposition forces, are you satisfied that Russia is responding positively to Washington's grievances?
Look, I mean, it's clear that through their military activities, the Russians have bolstered and supported the Assad regime. But there's also no question about the fact that they've agreed on two really key important things with us. One, you got to have a political solution in Syria that leads to a whole unified, non-sectarian Syria. Number two, that they were going to support and implement the cessation of hostilities. And there's absolutely no question that there are fewer Russian military warplanes flying today, as you and I speak, than there were a week or so ago before the cessation of hostilities.
You know, at the same time, the moderate rebels, the ones that Washington seems to be backing, they're feeling really under fire.
We're not walking away from the fact that there are still strikes being taken against opposition groups, and that needs to stop. That is absolutely in violation of the cessation of hostilities.
America's allies in Syria are at each other's throats right now. Reports coming in yesterday that Turkey had shelled America's Kurdish ally in Syria, the YPG forces in northern Aleppo province. Rebels and Kurds also fighting in the city. Is the U.S., you think, pursuing an impossible strategy by trying to reconcile these different allies, which have very different aims for the future of Syria?
No, absolutely not. I think what we've recognized from the very beginning that this was a complicated situation, and that even those members of the coalition working with us against Daesh had different views about what the future of Syria was going to look like.
Well, from here, it looks like what's most important now is to have international players at the table. Russia wants Assad to stay. Hasn't the U.S. essentially ceded that point to the Russians, at least for the time being?
No, I wouldn't characterize it that way at all. And I certainly won't speak for Moscow, but they have signed themselves up to a political solution in Syria that, again, gets us to a government that can lead to a Syria that's whole and unified. Look, but your question also raises another issue, and it's a fair one, that aside from Russia, there are, again, 19 other entities in the International Syria Support Group. And I'll tell you, not all of them have the same view of what the future of Bashar al-Assad ought to be.
If we think about the recent record of Western military intervention, Iraq, Afghanistan, Libya, there have been a lot of unintended consequences. You're a retired admiral. You were one of the faces of the Pentagon when the U.S. went into Iraq. So if you could get the ear of an incoming administration about Syria, what would you tell them?
Well, I want to stay out of campaign rhetoric and politics. That's not my job. It wasn't
yeah, we
my
don't
job.
Want campaign rhetoric. We want actual practical guidance.
I take it. You know, as you and I talk, there are millions of Syrians that have sought refuge outside the country and are flowing to Europe and are putting a strain on the EU's fabric. The answer to that crisis is to create a home for the Syrian people to go back to, away from Bashar al-Assad, so that the Syrian people don't have to worry about getting gassed or barrel bombed every day. And while I can't even begin to predict who's going to be the next president of the United States or how that individual will choose to address the challenges in Syria, what I can tell you is that Secretary Kerry will remain committed fully to trying to achieve this political solution in Syria for every day that he's left in office.
State Department spokesman John Kirby is a retired Rear Admiral in the U.S. Navy. Thank you very much for your time today.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
More than a million Syrians who fled the war since it started 5 years ago have crossed the border into Lebanon. But they're not the only ones taking refuge there. There are smaller groups of people from other countries, and they are also hoping to be granted refugee status so they can start new lives. But for now, they wait. Reporter Ari Daniel has our story.
When I met Abdullah Abubakar al-Jazuli in Beirut, he shook my hand, smiled gently, and told me about growing up in Sudan.
We were living the best life. We were living the simple life. We ate what we grew.
Al-Jazuli grew tomatoes and wheat. He raised cows and goats. Until 2003, when he turned 17, and the farm where he lived and worked in the region of Darfur fell into the heart of a war zone.
It was a mass extinction, a mass genocide from the Sudanese government to the sons and daughters of Darfur.
Bombs scorched farmland. People fled, lost track of one another. Al-Jazuli held on in Darfur until 2007, but it just got too dangerous. So he left, traveling through Syria to Lebanon.
Some friends of mine told me that there was a refugee office for people just like me who had come from Darfur and that they would help me and protect me.
Al-Jazuli is describing the UNHCR, the UN Refugee Agency. He went there to apply for refugee status, which he needed to get asylum abroad. He had 5 interviews over 9 months.
By the 9th month, they rejected me as a refugee.
He's not the only one who was turned down. Hashim Musa is also Sudanese, though not from Darfur, and he came to Lebanon seeking refugee status too.
The UN office has offered me nothing.
This situation prompted Al-Jazuli, Musa, and a handful of other Sudanese to organize a peaceful sit-in last summer in front of the UNHCR building in Beirut. Al-Jazuli says this kind of protest has succeeded in getting people resettled before, but this time it was different. And in October, he says a security team forcibly moved the protesters away from the entrance down the block.
One person held my hands back, one person hit me in the stomach, and they threw me over a metal gate.
Musa pulls up his pant leg to reveal a scar on his knee the size of a quarter.
5 people had jumped at me, one put me in a chokehold. And as they were pulling me out, I fell on my knees, and that's how I hurt my knee. To this day, I limp. I am shocked because this is the UN where they are supposed to take care of refugees.
The UNHCR, though, says it had nothing to do with the attacks.
Of course, this would be a bad practice that needs to be punished if need be. We're a humanitarian agency at the end of the day.
Dana Sleiman is the public information officer for UNHCR Lebanon. She says her agency's mission is to take care of those who qualify as refugees, but the demands are extreme. Lebanon is already host to more than 1 million displaced Syrians and some 2,200 Sudanese by her count.
Sudanese people in general in Lebanon have legitimate concerns and legitimate frustrations. We do appreciate the hardship that they're going through.
But she says not everyone can be resettled. Still, Sleiman says her office has sat down with everyone from Sudan to tell them about Lebanese agencies that can offer help. And she supports their sit-in.
I think it's important that they be heard.
Not just by people in Lebanon, but overseas as well. 100 feet or so from the UNHCR office, along an alley, I find Al-Jazuli, Musa, and 2 other Sudanese protesters. We sleep here every night, says Ahmad Abu Bakr.
Ahmad's taking me inside here. Oh.
I crouch below a tarp. The protesters have lined the sidewalk with cardboard. A series of sleeping bags are carefully arranged. Abu Bakr says there are 8 people living here on the street, including women and children. A cold, wet wind blows against the tarp. It'll be dark soon. Al-Jazuli tells me the eyes of much of the world are on Syrian refugees, and they're getting priority, even though the Sudanese have been asking for asylum for a decade. He says that's when you realize not all refugees are the same. For The World, Ari Daniel, Beirut.
The fishing industry here in New England has suffered a lot of setbacks in recent decades. None more devastating, though, than the collapse of the stocks of cod. It was once a main catch of local fishermen, but that's in the past now. At Seafood Expo North America, which wraps up today here in Boston, the big question is this: how do you get people to appreciate dogfish? It's still plentiful in New England waters and is popular in other parts of the world, like the UK, where it's served as fish and chips. Yet for some reason, dogfish just has not caught on here in the U.S. Nick Muto is one fisherman who'd love to change that. He's a member of the Cape Cod Commercial Fishermen's Alliance.
In the summertime, we find the dogfish literally as soon as we fall outside the harbor. We have miles of dogfish. Dogfish has become a mainstay of our fleet because of the decline of the codfish population, which has been subject to many factors. Warming ocean trends, overfishing, mismanagement, that's all led to the decline of the codfish population. But out of that has risen this emerging dogfish fishery that has become a real building block of our harbor.
How does it compare to cod in terms of size?
It's smaller than a lot of our large codfish. An average dogfish is 4 to 5 pounds. When we were catching a lot of codfish, we were up in the 8 to 10 pound range. So you're definitely catching more individual fish, but they are smaller, nicer fillets.
How does it compare in taste to cod?
I don't want to mislead anybody. It's not codfish, but it could be a good substitute. It's a nice, flaky white fish and very tasty.
So in the UK, as I said, as popular as fish and chips, no one seems to have a problem with it there. But here in its home, people are like, no dogfish for me. Why is that?
I think it's getting people to realize that there's life outside of codfish, haddock, swordfish, tuna, salmon. Those are fish that people are comfortable with. They've seen them. They've been comfortable with them for years. I'd like to see people start thinking outside the box because there's a lot of other fish out there that are equal to those big five. I think it could be a solid replacement for some of them so that we could take some of the pressure off of those more depleted stocks.
I'm sure you've sat out on the water and kind of mused, boy, it's probably something in the name if they just change the name.
Some of it is the name. If you look at examples like the Patagonian toothfish, you rebrand it as Chilean sea bass, it's a winner.
Right.
Cape shark could be a nice replacement for dogfish. But really, the true test of it is the actual product itself. And it is a solid replacement for some of these overfished, over-demanded stocks.
So you spent a couple of days at the Seafood Expo North America here in Boston. Are there efforts being made to kind of rebrand dogfish?
Rebrand it and create awareness around it, that it is actually a very abundant species. It's sustainable. It's domestic, and it's a thriving fish stock.
What did you see at the expo from Cape Cod Commercial Fishermen's Alliance? Are they kind of doing a little dogfish fry-up and getting people to taste?
We've done a couple of media lunches. We had dogfish prepared for lunch. We had some smoked dogfish mignettes, which were unbelievable, with a red pepper aioli.
Mm-hmm.
It's great. We had it fried, and then we had it pan-seared over like a wild rice, and they were all fantastic.
Nick, I saw this statistic recently that most of the fish consumed in the U.S. is imported from other countries. Is that right?
Right. Because of our depleted codfish stocks, we've started to fill that need for codfish here domestically. We've started importing codfish fillets from Iceland and Norway. So we import the codfish that we need to fill our demand here. But then we have this other fish, you know, a lot of these other fish species that we catch domestically, and that all gets exported. So if we're importing 90% and then we're exporting the other 90%, well, why aren't we just keeping what we catch here domestically and having it ourselves?
So what's the answer to that? Why not?
I think a lot of it lies in awareness, getting people to think outside the box, to change palates a little bit or get them to even experiment with these different types of fish. If we could bolster this market up a little, even by 10 or 20%, I feel it really serves as the foundation for the fishing businesses in our harbor.
So you'll be back out on the waters tonight?
We'll be back out on the water in 6 hours, and it'll be 36 hours on the water.
How much a dogfish are you going to haul in? Typically, in an evening?
This trip here, we're not targeting dogfish. Okay. In the summertime, our quote-unquote dogfish season, we leave anywhere between 3 and 4 in the morning, and we're back noontime, 1 o'clock during the day. We're very fortunate that there is such a great stock right out front of Chatham, so I don't have to go very far to catch them. It's become a nice part of my yearly business. So hopefully we can create awareness and create a demand for that, allow for us to continue to be on the water.
Nick Muto is a fisherman and a member of the Cape Cod Commercial Fishermen's Alliance. Nick Muto, thank you.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
I'm Marco Werman with The World. 2 years ago today, Malaysian Airlines Flight 370 mysteriously went off course and disappeared somewhere over the Indian Ocean. Despite the discovery of some debris, it remains one of the greatest aviation mysteries ever. The search for MH370 continues, though, and it's costing a lot of money. But Clive Irving, aviation correspondent for The Daily Beast, thinks it's worth it.
I talk to the Australians who are running this search on a fairly frequent basis, and they remain optimistic on the simple mathematical principle that the fewer miles there are left to search, the higher the probability of finding something is. And they do have very effective equipment, but the most striking thing is the amazing terrain under the ocean there. For example, recently they discovered that there were more than 220 undersea volcanoes which spew mud. The highest of those is about the same height as Vesuvius, about 5,000 feet. And yet,
wow.
And yet the summit of that volcano is still 1.3 miles below the ocean surface. The whole area has been, for the first time, has been mapped, which is an achievement for them to have done that. And they do have sonar scanning equipment that's sensitive enough to pick up something as small as a ship's anchor. And they have found several shipwrecks and shipping containers down there, but so far they haven't found any sign of the plane.
Is it possible that some of that mud has covered the plane at this point and they'll never find it?
I think they'll find it. I don't think the mud will cover the plane. I think there's a lot of silt down there. There's a lot of currents down there. It's very dark. You can't see anything. So, you know, sonar isn't a visual system. It's a sound system. So they pick it up and then they construct a kind of visual three-dimensional image from the sonar returns.
These people on this plane, tragic as it is, are all presumed dead. The search mission cost millions. Why is the search continuing? I mean, certainly not to map the ocean floor.
No, to understand what caused this extraordinary mystery, you need to get a hold of the wreckage. Otherwise, it can never be explained. You need physical evidence. This is like a murder case without a body. There are fragments that have been found, like the flapperon part of the wing that was found last year in Réunion. But that sits in Paris in the custody of the French judicial authorities. There's another fragment that turned up off the coast of Mozambique last week, which is on its way to Australia. It was supposed to be in Australia by now, but the Australians have said that they haven't received it yet. It's gone through Malaysia. And these are not enough to tell us what happened here. So we're left with a great deal of crazy theories about what happened and a few physical details. So it really is essential for this undersea search to be successful. Otherwise, we will be left, in the absence of any kind of wreckage, with the greatest aviation mystery of modern times unsolved.
And so the concern then is that this could happen to other planes.
Well, that's always going to be the concern in an unexplained accident. This is one of the world's safest aircraft, the Boeing 777, which is a paradox, really. So we have to assume that it had some kind of vulnerability that we don't know about yet and we need to discover.
And north of $120 million, that would be worth it?
Oh, absolutely. It's very essential. You know, modern aviation is so thoroughly safe and at the moment that when you get an anomaly like this, not only a plane that's crashed, but a plane that's disappeared as well as crashing, this is unknown in modern aviation. It has to be explained.
Clive Irving is the aviation correspondent for the Daily Beast. Thanks very much for your time.
You're welcome.
Finally today, Meldonium. No, it's not what Iron Man's new armor is made of, but it does make you stronger. Meldonium is the banned substance that tennis star Maria Sharapova just admitted to taking. She claims she'd been taking it for health reasons for years before it was banned and was not aware it was now on the banned substance list. But what is Meldonium and how can it enhance an athlete's performance? Patrick Wynn of our Global Post team has been investigating the drug. So, Patrick, why did Sharapova take this drug?
She took it to perform at a more extreme level. Athletes that are exposed to extreme conditions and have to compete at an extreme level like to take this drug because it jacks up the oxygen in your bloodstream. So you're supposed to be taking this drug because you've had a heart attack and you want oxygen in your bloodstream for that reason. But extreme athletes push their hearts so hard that they also can benefit from this drug.
Did Sharapova have any health reasons to take it?
She claims that she had a predilection for diabetes and some funny EKG results. You know, it's sort of like the guy who is finding an excuse to get his medical marijuana card. You know, oh, my back is hurting me.
Yeah. All right. So despite the reasons for her taking it, when was Meldonium banned and why was it banned?
Meldonium was banned in January. So very recently.
This year?
Yep. Yep. Just in January 2016.
And why? Because the sense is that it would be abused?
The World Anti-Doping Agency found out that there was a significant number of athletes who were taking this. They did one survey, and I think they found about 2% of the people they surveyed had this in their bloodstream. And again, these athletes, they can go for days and days and days performing at extreme levels if they take this drug.
So I've never heard of Meldonium. Where does it come from?
Meldonium comes from Latvia. former USSR country. And I was actually able to reach the inventor of this drug, a Latvian guy. Mm. His name is Professor Ivars Kalvins. He's a very jovial guy, and he's very proud of this drug because he says it saved millions of lives, particularly in the USSR, former USSR countries. He's also very defensive of athletes taking it. He says, you know, they're legitimately pushing their hearts really hard, and they need to recover, and it can actually save their lives. He's really emphatic about this. He said that it's unbelievable that the doping agency made such a stupid decision, in his words, and that this was a human rights issue.
Did Professor Kalvin convince you of it being a decent thing for athletes?
I think it can certainly enhance their performance, but the World Anti-Doping Agency says that anything you put in your body to enhance your performance is wrong. Human rights issue? No, that's a bit much.
Okay, so the World Anti-Doping Agency, that's the body that governs all this stuff. Do we live in a world, though, where we have two standards for what is acceptable and what is not, if this professor kind of upholds this, or is that just ego speaking?
I think that might be a little ego speaking. I like the guy in the conversation I had, so I hate to talk bad about him. But, you know, look, Sharapova can take this drug tomorrow if she wants. She just can't compete.
Right. So after looking into the doping world, Patrick, what are your thoughts on such drugs like Meldonium that seem to have therapeutic benefits but are being used in sports?
Right. So I think it needs to be a level playing field. If they're going to allow it, allow everyone to take it. If they're going to ban it, they need to find ways to make sure people aren't sneakily taking it so that the playing field is level. But, I mean, let's face it, going out and working out in a gym is not a natural thing to do either. It really comes down to substances. They don't like substances going in your body.
Fair play, people. Patrick Wynn of our Global Post team, thanks very much.
Thanks a lot.
That's Game, Set, and Match. Another round tomorrow from the Nan and Bill Harris Studios at WGBH here in Boston. I'm Marco Werman. See you then.
PRI, Public Radio International.